whatever, they want to go, but it's still coming in, please help yourself to tea and whatever there is. There's no tea vacant, so quietly members can help refresh themselves. Everyone's only welcome. You missed a very, very interesting day yesterday. Very exciting. I won't say fireworks, but very exciting. Eh? Very good candidates. Dr. Titus, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. Very well, thank you, sir.
Have you been to Parliament before?
Many times, thank you.
Oh, so you're familiar with all the processes? And the
not with all, but some.
Okay, but first time before this committee?
First time, yes.
Welcome to you. Interview will last about 35, 40 minutes maybe. Maybe a bit longer, depending on your responses. We're going to give you 3 to 5 minutes just to talk through your CV and maybe tell us why you think you'll be a worthy candidate for the SCBC board. Thereafter, members would pose questions and you respond to each member at a time. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen. As you've seen from my CV, I am not within the broadcasting business. I think I fall within the category of, as explained in the non-executive directors, that they are drawn from a wide range of backgrounds and interest groups and bring to the board the benefit of diverse skills and experience. And applied collectively, these should help to enhance the growth, prosperity, and accountability of the corporation. And I quote from the annual report as was made available to me. I really was quite surprised when I was approached to be nominated. And after having thought through it, I thought, well, I certainly think I can make a contribution, sir, because the SCBC board is certainly a very pressing focal point in the country at the moment, and I can imagine that there's really lots and lots of work that the board will be entrusted with, certainly in terms of what was presented in the media around matters of serious mismanagement, corruption, political meddling, and the financial crisis. My own approach to the board will be, Chairperson, to focus on the board and to look at what is required of a board and to look at what is required of governance in terms of addressing the issues. And having played through the documents, particularly the annual report, it is very interesting to me to see that all the systems are in place, all the governance systems are in place, all the policies have been fairly well developed. And the question is, with all these kinds of commitments, because it is stated very clearly that the SCBC is committed to upholding the highest levels of corporate governance and therefore embraces the principles of best governance practice as set out in the 2002 King report, and I assume that will also apply to the King 3 as well. And the question is, therefore, if all these systems are in place, and if the governance is so well established, board performance evaluation set out very clearly, 12 board committees, including an executive committee that is responsible for the day-to-day running of the organization of the corporation. The question is then why? Why the mismanagement? Why the allegations of corruption? Why the allegations of political meddling and the financial crisis? Chairperson, it is then that I come to the conclusion that the issue at hand is a reflection of our state of the nation, is nothing less and nothing more than what we experience in our country at the moment with the best constitution, the best legislative frameworks, lots of work that went into it. But when it comes to the implementation phase, it has been stated over and over again that we are really stuck and we remain stuck in that area, and that is my impression from the outside, that this is where things need to be become unstuck. Or as they say, this is where there's this major slip between the cup and the lip. But my sense, Chairperson, is then that when addressing these issues, it's also a people issue. People that have to manage these issues, people that have to implement these very well-established commitments to governance, to corporate governance, to sound management, etc. So I think we need to look very carefully at what is happening when people have to manage, when people have to be trained. And also what concerns me, and I would like to stop there for the moment, is the reference to a robust evaluation system that has been put in place. And again, if I may quote from the annual report, it says, the company secretary, together with the remuneration committee and the human resources committee, are responsible for ensuring that a robust evaluation system is in place. And then I read, no evaluation was conducted during the year under review as the board's term was about to expire. Question is why? Why no evaluation? Why is this a sound enough reason? Because the board's term was going to expire. If this is the issue in terms of management, if this is the issue in terms of taking the immense responsibility of this corporation further, why don't we have that kind of evaluation? And then I ask myself, and this is not to badmouth anybody or to put myself above other people's competencies and capacities. I'm just saying, with the information at hand, sir, there was no robust evaluation in 2008. And I must then also ask, with very little information at hand, was the group CEO evaluated? Was the CFO evaluated? And the COD? And if they were, how was it done? Because there's also a way of monitoring, a way of assessing performance, a way of evaluation. Those are areas I think that one should look at very carefully if you have the responsibility, the fiduciary responsibility of corporate governance. If you sit at a board such as the SABC board, those are the issues I would like to focus on, and not necessarily myself, but in cooperation, collaboration with the whole of the board. I think the board will have to clarify itself as to its particular role of governance and each individual member. So it will be useful, yes, to bring our respective competencies, expertises, backgrounds, but within the context of this governance approach. So I would very much like to focus upon that. And the question is then, all these committees of the board, were they evaluated in terms of their work? The Human Resources Committee, the Finance Committee, the Audit Committee, etc., etc. Because evaluation has become a skill, evaluation has become a particular competence, and again, when it comes to the immense nature of this corporation at this level, where the board is the supreme authority, where the board really has the authority to carry this organization, or this corporation, then we need to increase and improve the standards of evaluation. And it really is such a wonderful tool and opportunity to really get to the heart of the organization. Traditionally, there's always the issue of governance and management, and the line between them, and it is said that is a sacred line. Managers manage, boards of directors govern, and there should not be confusion between the two. And that is where we find, whatever corporation we speak about, when the troubles start, it is when that line is being blurred. When managers become governors, and when directors responsible for governance started to manage. Managers should really be able to manage. And that relationship between the board and the management should be very, very clear, because management reports to the board. Management are accountable to the board. But that line, yes, it's very clear, but it has also been proven almost, that the board cannot be just a referee. The board will have to have much more sense of governance in terms of not only steering the ship, but sitting at the lookout point to also look at the broader strategic visions where this organization, this corporation is going to. So there is an improved and increased responsibility, sir, if I may, when it comes to the board, not only to work on monitoring and evaluation, which is important, but that is looking backwards. That is just trying to do the monitoring role, to do the refereeing role, Did you do X? Didn't you do X? But the board has a broader, expansive role as well, and that is to guide the broad strategic vision of not only vision but process. So the board, it is said, it's not always an issue of fraud or corruption or greed that really fails corporations. It's a lack of effective decision making. And boards are usually complacent, comfortable, not to really display their ignorance of operational processes. But despite that, yes, managers will manage and they will keep the board informed, but the board must be able to come up with quality, effective decision making and to guide that particular process. So, in a word, that would be my overall approach. I have some experience in corporate governance. I really like to follow this as far as possible in my current work. I report to a board of directors, and I think with this kind of an approach, I would like to make my contribution.
Okay, thank you very much. Maybe I wasn't too clear when I introduced this. We had asked you to talk to your CV, and you've gone into a long discussion on the board and the critique of the board. But it's fine, it's part of the discussion, but can I get back to your CV? I see that between 1983 and 1987, you were a public prosecutor and a controlled prosecutor. Where exactly were you based, and who were you prosecuting? Because if I remember, that was the height of the state of emergency, and I'd like to know who you were prosecuting. And then the second thing is I see from 1987 to 1993, your CV says nothing about what you were doing. It might just be that you know, it's a typo error, you forgot to include that, but I'd like to know what you were doing in that six-year period. You could help us with that, and then we can take a discussion forward from there.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think that those are very pertinent questions. When we were enrolled as law students at the University of the Western Cape, there were only funding from the state to teachers. And the teachers were put in a position to complete their studies through that kind of bursary. The obligation was that they should work within the state system and sort of repay the bursary in that way. When we decided to broaden our horizons to move beyond the traditional occupations, we moved...
Sorry, who's we?
Students at the University of the Western Cape, myself, shall I say then, as a law student.
Asking you the question.
Yes, of course. That refers to me. I'm sorry to use the we. When I did that, that was the circumstances at the time. And we then got, in the midst of our studies, we were given bursaries from the Department of Justice. The condition was similar, that we should rework, or rather work our... bursary period off, 1 year longer than for the period that you received the bursary. We had a concern with that, we being the law students at the time, and approached the Director General, Advocate Kutzer at the time, through Professor Richard van der Ross, Director of the University, that we do have concerns about working for the Department of Justice as prosecutors because we did not agree with the past laws or the security legislation at the time, and we would like to be exempted from that. According to him, through Professor van der Ross, was that that is fine, they will make provision for that. When the time came for us to go and when we had to finish our studies, the response that we got back from the department was that there's no positions for colored prosecutors. And we just decided there is no way that we are going to repay this, and we had to take the department on as students. And successfully managed to do that. There were about five or seven of us, and we were posted throughout the country, and they said we must be prepared to go and work anywhere. I was posted at Mbisa, other friends in Soweto, others New Brighton, etc. So we were allocated into those kind of areas. In the Department of Justice at the time, the type of cases that we were presented, that I was presented with, were largely assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm, petty crimes, drug offenses, drunken drivings, etc. Those were the areas that we had to work in. Although when the Department of Bantu Affairs, I don't know what it was at the time, decided that the past laws were on its way out, they first brought it through the Department of Justice. And then we were required to prosecute past law matters as well. But a completely different way than the commissioner's courts, because here we required affidavits from arresting officers, which they never had to do in the past. A number of those cases were withdrawn, but I don't want to make it the moral issue was different. The moral issue was the same. I then approached the chief magistrate and informed him of the discussion with the Director General Kutzer that we would be exempt. And his view was, you can take that up with the department, but as far as we are concerned, you either do it or you're out. Within about 8 months to 9 months, the past laws were scrapped. But I can say that the lessons learned, the experience that I was exposed to as a prosecutor really was, in my view, extremely valuable. In terms of the skills learned, and I still believe that the Department of Justice is a very important school for anybody wanting to understand the skills of cross-examination, managing a court role, etc. When I was in the position to head the Department of Justice's College of Justice about 2007-08, I really found that it stood me in a very good stead also in managing that, and also to show to the prosecutors and the magistrates that I do understand where they're coming from. So in that sense, we were never required to prosecute security legislation or cases of political nature. Again, not to ameliorate the moral issue around that, it still remained an issue. When you are in a system, what do? When you are in such a system, I can go further if you want me to. As to the period you asked me, sir, 87 to 93, that was the period when I left the country and to study in the Netherlands. I got a scholarship from the German organization to study in the Netherlands, where I was given the opportunity to explore the issue of human rights. More the issue of international law of human rights, not so much the constitutional one, that too, and also to realize that there's a broader case to human rights than just your constitution. You are also being given rights from the international community, the United Nations, the African Union, etc., and those rights also need to find a way to have an interplay between the constitutional rights. That is what I did in those 6 years. I was also then given the opportunity in 1993 to attend a very intense diplomats course with 33 ANC diplomats in Spain, in The Hague, Klingendahl Institute of International Affairs, where we were trained as diplomats to come and assist with the transition process. I was fortunate for that in that regard as well.
Thank you very much. Sorry and Stele.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Although your questions have covered my concern about the gap that I saw in the CV, between 1983 and 1990. I've got one other question to ask Dr. Titus. I'm sorry, Dr. Titus. I didn't even greet you. Good morning.
Good morning, ma'am.
Yes. You have made an assessment of the mandate of the board and also of what you think about the management. But there is one thing of you have left out. I didn't hear you talking about it. What if you can explain to us a candid funding model that you think would be quite viable for the SABC to use? Is it funding from government or the corporate world, or what do you think about the view of privatizing the SABC? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Muruta.
Did you get the last one?
I did.
Okay, fine.
I did. Around the funding model and the possibility of privatization. I think if we look at the immense responsibilities placed upon the South African Broadcasting Corporation in terms of a public organization being closely aligned to the transformation agenda of this country, being a vehicle in the position of implementing rights and aligning itself with a more developmental nature of our South African state, then I need to say that to privatize a corporation like this would certainly not be assisting in that kind of mandate. The mandate is just too broad. It's just too immense. It's just too wide open to the millions and millions of South Africans. We will not have the finances to, in the case of TakeNet, for example, to have a particular channel just for their benefit, and obviously it costs money. It costs a lot of money. I therefore cannot align myself with one-sided privatization, but it would also not be right just to say that this organization can run like a state corporation without proper principles, without proper management, without proper business principles. I think that any corporation of this nature should certainly not run like a broad kind of old, outdated civil service organization. There's lots of good examples from civil service, and I really acknowledge that. We shouldn't just accept business as is, and it should really draw from the best that there is available. I have not seen the documentation, and I really would like to be informed, should I be on the board, to have an opportunity to really go through all that documentation, because a lot of work has been done on the issue of hybrid funding, on the issue of advertising income, and having that kind of dual approach. I think that would be an area where the board will have to take a very clear position on that. But I also would like to say that the state has a special responsibility to increase its subsidy to the SABC board. So what I'm trying to say is there's mixed bag of many. I do not accept a one model. I think there is an argument for both, a dual model. But also beyond that, when it comes to the management, and that's what I harped upon in my introduction, they will have to be very careful management structures and governance structures in order to manage the funding and the finances of the organization properly. I think I've dealt with the funding model and the privatization aspect.
Thank you, Chair Pepe, and good morning, Dr. Chaitas.
Good morning.
I think first and foremost, I will ask one simple question. That will be the first one. Do you affiliate to any political party?
No, ma'am.
And then secondly, in your presentation, there was a lot of the whys and the how parts in regard to the evaluation mechanism of the former SABC board. Not SACP, SACP board. Sorry for that.
Perhaps that could not be too inappropriate.
SABC board, there was this lot of whys and the how part of it in terms of the evaluation from your part. I'm interested to know what answers did you get when you were just digesting those questions, playing around with them. What answers do you have? What can you tell us about those evaluations? What gaps? Because obviously you have observed some gaps in that regard. What are those gaps? And in terms of the oversight, the role model, it overlaps to that. What do you think needs to be done more that is not done now? And how frequently do you think it must be done, in particular by this panel? And in addition to the issue of the funding model, all the participants or the people who have been interviewed were saying that many South Africans are not paying for their TV licenses. What do you think must be done in order to close that gap of payment? What encouragement can we do to our society to motivate them to pay for their TV licenses? Lastly, Chair, on the issue of the language policy, what can you tell us about, do you think enough has been done, especially in terms of the indigenous languages, including the sign language, or something more needs to be done? If there's something more needs to be done, according to you, what must be done? What is it that is still lacking, or do you think all is fine and all is well? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chebe, Chairperson. As to the last question, no, certainly not. All is certainly not fine. I am a member of the Afrikaans Language Board, which is an organization that came together last year around the language of Afrikaans. So I have some sense of what's happening in that kind of language, or in that language. As to indigenous language, sign languages, I think certainly much more can be done. This is also one of the major challenges that the SABC as a corporation has in terms of the 11 languages. I would just like to see, in a word, serious discussions, engagement with stakeholders, the people that really experience this as a major concern, but also beyond that, the Commission for Religion, culture, religion, and linguistic rights should also be put in a position where it can express itself more firmly and have a clearer relationship with the board. It is a commission that has always been closed down by the ASMA report. I think they will have a further lifespan, but I think they should also be brought on board. So what I'm trying to say is that there are authoritative and authentic stakeholders that can really assist in that, and I would like from a board side or from a corporation side like to see that kind of interaction. Again, with the difference between governance and management, this to me would be a clear management issue where the board from a governance side will give the kind of direction to the board, and then also to latch on to your earlier point then of evaluation, how do we evaluate this? The gap that I've identified, and I said that was just by just perusing through the report, is that it was not done. I would like to see that it is done, and I would like to see that there is a credible, acceptable method of evaluation. And also in terms of your period that you ask for, the particular routine, I would think at most 3 times a year to have that kind of evaluation. But not an evaluation to hit people over the fingers or anything of that sort, but really to enhance the core business of the organization. Because once you have that established rhythm in any corporation where people can come and present what they've done and be given a proper evaluation, that is when those activities will move over, or not necessarily move over or spill over, but will be integrated with performance management, with performance management systems, with bonus systems, with appropriate remuneration And that is what it is there for. That is the oversight role. That is the oversight role. That is the meaning of fiduciary responsibility. That is the meaning of responsibility that you take upon yourself when you sit on a board, that you also take personal responsibility for what is happening in the organization. And those are the systems, as I said in the beginning, that the SABC in its documentation commits itself to, but we need to move to that particular implementation. There are different ways of evaluation, and the board can avail itself of those different mechanisms and look at the current one. What we do have in front of us is an outcome that is completely undesirable, an outcome that needs to be attended to and addressed very seriously, very urgently, amongst all other matters, I would say. But with this kind of incisive and, as in the words of the ACBC itself, robust evaluation, I certainly see let's say in a period of 2 to 3 to 6 months that it can move itself out of this particular quagmire.
Morning, Doctor.
Good morning, sir.
How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you.
I can see you're on the road. If you're still at your youth life, I was going to say we are rocking.
Thank you, sir.
No, I've got only 4 questions. I'm aware that you are a good citizen, you are paying your TV license. But I must inform you that it's about to expire. So 1st of October, go and renew it.
Yesterday I was thinking about this. And Mr. Van der Berg kept on speaking about the NIA. But he comes from the Parliamentary Intelligence Service. And I won't say what the acronym stands for.
But we appreciate that you know what is the right thing to do, because we are paying you to be licensed. Keep it up and encourage other doctors to do so.
I certainly will do that. I'm a bit concerned that my information is so publicly available, but you will see that I've done that for the past 20 years.
My first question, Doctor, is around the issue of the intervention you're talking about in terms of the evaluation. I will think that the management will be easy because the board will do that. But I need to get your view in terms of who's going to evaluate the board members. The reason why I'm raising this matter is because the SABC board, as a board, is highly contested. If you say it should be the minister, others will say that will be the interference of the executive in the SABC running. I'm not sure what you have in mind in terms of that matter, in terms of how do you see that being done, in what manner. Maybe you can share with us. The second issue is that how have you seen the intervention of this committee in terms of dissolving the board and putting in the interim board? What is your comment around that particular matter? The other question is in relation to the issue of conflict of interest. The president has committed government on behalf of the people of South Africa that we need to fight this demon of corruption as far as possible, or we must do whatever we can to make sure that we fight it. But you've got a situation as things stand now where the legislation allows. I know that is our responsibility to amend laws and so on. But what's your view in relation to where members of the board, including to a certain extent the senior managers, they've got direct business interests with the SABC. When you raise that matter, you are told that the law is saying you must declare so that you don't participate to the final decision making. The managers will say the policy of the SABC is saying you must have a disclosure of interest and so on. Is that sufficient to deal with this difficult matter which we are facing as a country currently? The last question. It's in relation. There's a matter which we were at one point as an African National Congress. We look into it in terms of trying to make a possibility that Parliament does have a dedicated channel so that the people of South Africa can follow the discussion of Parliament. I'm sure you are aware now as a good citizen who pays the TV license that those people without the pay TV who does not have access to pay TV, they've got limited programs which shows what Parliament can do and so on. What's your view on that matter? Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Kowani, Chairperson. I'm glad to hear that there is moves afoot for this dedicated channel. But I can say the current commercial channel is also not really showing up anything interesting. There's many times when I switch onto that channel, there's practically nothing on it. And Parliament needs to decide to what extent it is attractive to the people out there or irrelevant to the people out there. Does a channel like this, will it necessarily make a difference? That is really for Parliament to decide. I think it is important in terms of the gap that we experience between Parliament and the communities out there, perceived or otherwise, that we need to find ways to close that and to make this institution more accessible and more understandable to people out there. And also, I would imagine, please, not only the debates or people falling asleep, give us something of substance, give people something that they would like to enjoy, that they can see the quality of your debates, the quality of your interaction with each other. We sometimes have the intention or the perception that there's major fights in here, where in fact when you go to tea or to lunch or discussions, it's across party lines, which is not an impression that we see out there. We can really do quite a lot to our conflictual situation that we experience, to really see how you, as parliamentarians, in such a professional way, interact with each other, but differ on substance, differ on debates, etc. So yes, I think such a channel would be valuable, but it will have to be more than what we see at the moment, and it will have to have a little bit more interviews, discussions, guidance from commentators, etc., on something that can really be attractive and can take the debates forward. As the conflict of interest and the matter of corruption fight, I'm also, you've noted in my CV, at the moment the chairperson of the Board of Directors of Transparency International in South Africa. Very small organization, but quite large in internationally. And I think we should also make use, in terms of your question, sir, we cannot just stop with legislation. We cannot just stop and say, but the policies make provision for this. We really will have to dig much deeper and see to what extent these conflict of interest, these kinds of businesses that people have, to what extent does that infringe on the core business of the SABC. And I cannot see and stand for the life of me that you can be approached about your million rand Mercedes Benz and then just be approached by COSATU and say, but you must say sorry, and then you say sorry, and then it is over. It really cannot be acceptable, and it is not acceptable. So in the same way, just to say, yes, I have these businesses because I must declare, is really defeating the purpose. I would like to say, let us move to the core business and see to what extent does this affect the core business, to what extent does this affect the credibility, the sound judgment of people in those positions when it comes to the organization. And when you weigh that up, and also when you compare it a little bit with international practice, this cannot be acceptable. Declaring the conflict of interest obviously is a standing point on any board's agenda, and people should make use of that particular opportunity. You asked about the evaluation on the board and on management. Yes, it sounds easy, but again, to me, it's a question of what kind of system do you put in place. It is not just a easy chat. It is really something that has substance, that has process, that has implications and consequences. It is not just talking to people. It's really to sit down with the Human Resources Committee or the Finance Committee or the Audit Committee or whatever committee and really to evaluate them in terms of the outputs of their work, the kinds of commitments that they've made, the contracts that they've, no, not contracts that they've signed, but the undertakings that they've given. So it is to me a credible and acceptable system. Because that is your first discussion in such an evaluation, is how do we set the standards, how do we set the parameters, upon which do you want to be judged or not. And then to have that interaction in terms of the quality of work done. You ask the question of who would evaluate the board. I really wouldn't have a problem even if it is a minister, as long as the system is acceptable, as long as the process is very clear, because you always have the right of response to whoever evaluates you. And if it's the minister, you certainly will have that. But you obviously don't want to have eternal debates on these matters. As long as it can be an outside panel, it can be an independent panel, which may be addressing the issue of your concern in terms of political meddling. But again, if your system is as clear in terms of political meddling, then you should say so. And if you have an opportunity to note the concerns that came through, you should do that. Perhaps as I'm talking through it now, an independent panel may be more advisable. But I do not exclude the relevance and the appropriateness of the minister in that. Chairperson, I think I've covered the question.
Okay, I'm going to take three hands quickly and then I'm closing. It's Patricia, Julie, and Indiwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Titus, I see that you are currently the director of the ARTICAFIA, and you're also serving on the Afrikaans, the Taal
Raad.
Taal Raad. Thank you. Please, Michelle. Thank you. Do you think that Afrikaans is under threat? And if so, why do you think so? Because if, for instance, say that we are going to appoint you to the board of the SABC, will you be in a position to promote and protect other languages too? Do you think other languages deserve the same status as Afrikaans in our country? Because, you know, just following in the newspapers, some of the debates about Afrikaans language, you know, it's almost as if the language is under threat, and maybe you can enlighten us on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. No, I do not think Afrikaans is under threat. Our experience is that the Afrikaner community is under threat, and they view this as one of the opportunities where they had to lose power, and that this is difficult to get used to a new democratic South Africa. If we look at the arguments posed by the attorney Lawrence against this parliament, the state president, the Minister of Arts and Culture, the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development that were recently presented in the Constitutional Court. And if we look at the government's arguments against that, And we clearly see that it is really not a question of putting a language under threat to diminish a language at all. It is really a question of trying to find a balance in terms of what is relevant for the whole of South Africa. And when we speak, or when government is arguments, I don't speak on behalf of government, but just to say what the arguments were, say that English is the broader acceptable language to the majority of the South Africa. It is not a question, as it has been perceived in the Afrikaans community, of verengelsing, as they call it. Nothing to do with that at all. Verengelsing has more to do with the Anglo-Boer War. And there are so many millions of South Africans that speak Afrikaans that are not white, do not experience the same kind of threat of Afrikaans. As someone said recently, he thinks Afrikaans is now being put into its proper place, and that is painful, along with other languages, and not in a dominant position. With that, I do not say that Afrikaans should be annihilated, that Afrikaans should be moved off the face of South Africa. If we take Afrikaans out of the society, it will have an identity crisis in South Africa. We just cannot remove Afrikaans from South Africa. So the fact that we are looking at the values of Afrikaans, the experience, the expertise that have developed over the years around Afrikaans, the invitation has always been to assist other languages that are also struggling with mother tongue instruction in terms of the value of it, and not necessarily to just move into English as the so-called language of civilization. It is not necessarily the case. We would like to argue with other languages that mother tongue languages is certainly very, very important. However, we want to use our arguments in terms of the broader good of the South African society to continue to agitate for it, to continue to stand for it, because we find, particularly here in the Western Cape, that this one language policy is affecting the people of Mitchell's Plain. They're already doing that with single medium schools, English schools, now only in Mitchell's Plain. And our information is also that the teachers from the West Coast are really concerned about this direction, that it is going to affect them, that they are speaking Afrikaans, it is important for the advancement of them educationally. There is a clear pedagogic argument for that to be made, and we're trying to find out how that is going to be affected. So what I'm trying to say, Mr. Lowell, is that the language as such is not under threat, but there are areas that we need to find to present the case of Afrikaans as a credible language. The old idea of Afrikaans as the language of the oppressor, as it was stated from 1976, Soweto is a clear one. However, here in the Western Cape in 1976, students threw their stones in Afrikaans. We resisted apartheid in Afrikaans in the Western Cape. That is never recognized or given credence. But the struggle in the Western Cape largely was in Afrikaans. So it is not the language that is the problem. And Mr. Mandela expressed this very clearly in his document, Reflections in Prison from Mr. Maharaj, where that was very clearly stated. And incidentally, I think on the 7th or the 9th of June, 1976, he penned down those thoughts, very extensive thoughts on the island around Afrikaans, saying that you cannot impute this kind of legacy or description to a language as being oppressive, because in the same way, as he said, English should be an oppressive language, Spanish, Latin, Dutch, Portuguese should all be. So it is really a vibrant debate around this issue that you've raised. It's quite a vibrant debate, but we try to remain as sober as possible. When it comes to the SABC, it is a question of showing what kind of advantage Afrikaans had, and to use those advantages to the broader South African society.
Yes, just a fourth small objection. Dr. Thatcher did say the language is not under threat, but the Afrikaner community. Just briefly, who will you define as the Afrikaner community?
Yes, another difficult one. But largely the Afrikaner white community who had voting rights in South Africa. And when we interact with people around the issue of Afrikaans as a threat. It is more that people view themselves in terms of their minority status as being under threat, and people obviously experience the loss of power and the loss of former glory as very crucial, and that is why there is a retreat into these kinds of language debates, and that is why we have the interface consistently between Afrikaans-speaking people that are from the colored experience and Afrikaans-speaking people from the white experience, where on the colored experience the focus is much more on the empowerment of Afrikaans, to look at Afrikaans in the Western Cape, in the trade unions, in the on the farms, at the West Coast in particular, to realize that people can, through that language of Afrikaans, also be empowered. That argument is not necessarily the same one when we speak to white Afrikaans speakers, but at this council where we find ourselves, the Stalraad, these debates are being fleshed out, and we're beginning to see each other's viewpoint, and we're beginning to understand the diversity of language, but diversity in terms of the broader South African diversity.
Can I just ask one question from my side? I mean, two questions. One is, why would a full-time functionary of the Afrikaner Taal and Kultuur Vereniging that you are want to serve on the SABC board? And secondly, I might be wrong here, were you the convener of this group of colored professionals and intellectuals recently, or 2 years ago or so, concerned about the future of the colored people? Am I right? Were you the convener?
Yes, yes, very much.
Because it's not in your CV. What's behind that?
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, my CV is much more extensive than my work at the Arte Café at the moment. My work at the Arte Café offers me an opportunity to work cross-culturally, to share the diversity of Afrikaans with white people as well as with colored people, and with people speaking Afrikaans beyond those particular groups, because it's spoken all over. And the Arte Café just recently had one of its mission statements at a conference where we focus on the cultural home of all Afrikaans speakers. So it's an inclusive organization. It moved away from its exclusivity, which was still up till 1991. We have continuous discussions with the ANC leadership, with the DA leadership, and with political parties around these issues. In fact, we had two meetings at the Thule House on the issue, and we're continuing with that in the sense of nation building, holding hands, and really value each other's involvement. We spent a whole day with Mr. Zuma in Sandton, and also at his house. From his side, the discussion at the time was around not so much not a parliament, but the Ministry of Minorities. There were research done around that to see how do we and how can we and should we give more credence and effect to the diversity of cultures in South Africa. And in that sense, your question in terms of how do I see that playing a role on the SABC board, sir, I think the SABC board is representative of South African society. It should be, and is reflective of the needs and interests of all South Africans. And should be so. I think it cannot move into another exclusivism. We need to really take on the challenges of inclusivity and of a post-apartheid South Africa, which does not necessarily provide us with the same answers. I mean, the answers of the past do not apply to present-day South Africa. We really need to look afresh, look new, look each other in the eyes. The apartheid walls have come down, and we have different kinds of challenges. As to the colored organization that we started, was also around the issue of colored people feeling themselves marginalized, feeling themselves not part of South African society, and in themselves marginalized themselves. Almost in the sense of Steve Biko's statement around the mind of the oppressed as being this major ally to the oppressor. We need to find and to fight those matters at the minds of people. And this is what this movement started to do, to tell colored people that they do not need to sit on the sideline, that there is a broad South Africa that they can become part of, that we do not need to get stuck into our socioeconomic difficulties, which are immense, that it can make differences, and that people are making differences. And then lastly, that there are economic opportunities information that they don't know about that we need to provide to them. And again, as to the implication that this may be exclusive, when we look at colored people, we are as inclusive as possible. We've got white coloreds, we've got Indian coloreds, we've got African coloreds, and we've got colored coloreds.
Can you let me define all of that now? Am I included?
Obviously included, sir. I'd love to engage more if you want me to, sir, but I'll say that.
Good morning, Dr. Platt.
Good morning.
My question to you has got to do with how you see the SABC's role in South African society. We've had a quite robust, I think, discussion with you about questions around nation building, around discussions between previously divided peoples and so on. What role do you think the SABC plays in that? And how do you see... we've had this discussion about language, about culture, and so on. What role do you think the SABC plays in terms of, do you think it must, reflect the people of South Africa back to themselves? And if so, how? What are the challenges it faces, and what can you do to advance that cause?
Thank you very much. That is quite a very serious question. I don't think I will do justice to it in such a short space of time. But I would, from my human rights background, like to say that it is about freedom of expression. And freedom of expression is expression of diversity. And to give the diverse nature of our country the opportunity, as you said, to reflect upon themselves, to see themselves, to make visible what is happening in our society. We see that already, but I think we should really increase that much, much more. When I was in Holland, there was something that struck us, my wife and myself, the fact of their statement to their children is, come up for yourself, stand up for yourself. And that can only be done by freedom of expression, where you can know that you are free to express yourself in the way that you want to express yourself. You know, freedom of expression is those rights that are called in the human rights parlance, the modality rights, the how-to. That while we have the issue around the socioeconomic challenges, the immense problems we face around service delivery, municipalities, etc., that it is through freedom of expression that we bring those things to the fore. And if we can bring that to the South African society through the SABC, where people can really feel that they may say what they want, that there will not be any meddling, that they don't need to look over their shoulders, that they are being taken seriously in terms of what they say, that we collectively as a society can move up one level. I think the SABC as a public broadcaster has that particular role. The quality of our debates on television really can move up a level or two. The opportunity for young people to express themselves, the opportunity for poor people to express themselves. So I would say that with that kind of mandate that is already inherent in the SABC, that it can and should make a major contribution, and it is already doing quite well, but again, as I say, it can and should increase now. The whole thing of our democracy that's been coming on for so many years, in our eyes, it is really putrid sometimes, but you look it through the eyes of people from the outside, as you may have experienced, people are still appalled about this miracle that we pulled off in South Africa. We're not communicating that enough. And I think the SABC can and should do that much more. And then, having said that, I think there's a new area, and that is the area of diversity of cultures. How we get together when we enter one particular marketplace, and how we interact from our different bases, from our different cultures, and the value of that diversity of cultures. If you look at the British comedies, how they have these documentaries and soapies around the British culture and the Indian culture or Jamaican culture, and how they play with that and really bring that and make people to laugh at themselves as well. We've got so many examples in South Africa around our own diversity that is an area I think we should consciously foster and bring out in our soapies. There are soapies where it's starting to happen. So in a word, then again, freedom of expression, I think, is a major opportunity that's already inherent in the SABC.
Dr. Kaitas, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
And for participating in the interview. Members, you can have a 3-minute stretch break, but you're not going leaving the room as we're getting the next candidate in.